Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You hang up being there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Out.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer at the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity weight, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. It's amazing. But everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. And his laws are unchangeable. They serve as an infallible guide to meet every crisis, every change in life. If we can rise sufficiently out of the rut into which any situation or circumstance has pushed us and apply the same basic laws to our particular situation as preceding generations have used, we'll find the same result. God's laws never change. Everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. For example, as a man thinketh, so is he. An understanding heart is the most precious of earthly possessions. Man is master of his mind, and hence master of all circumstances. These laws have always been basic. They're just as true now as 2,000 years ago, or even 5,000 years ago. God never abandons us, even though, as the 23rd Psalm so clearly assures us, we may walk in the valley of death. He provides the strength he knows is necessary for us whenever we need it. Such are fundamental laws which apply to every situation, terrifying or not. Everything in life has a purpose. We may wonder sometimes what purpose some misfortune can have, but every event has its role in the growth of the human soul. Sometimes the purpose is not revealed for years, or if we fail to exert the strength God gave us, perhaps is never known to us during our passage on earth. But nevertheless, everything that happens to each of us has its share in the growth of our soul. No matter how unpleasant any situation may appear, how far removed at first sight from any seeming possibility for good, this fact remains. What happens to each of us is part of the Creator's divine plan, and how we react is the privilege which God has given us. The way we react represents the freedom extended to each of us by God. No intelligent human can fail to take hope, watching the intricate mechanism of life, with each minute's experience fitting perfectly into the overall life pattern. A bee buzzes as her path crosses a little too closely our own. A bird chirps a cheery call to its mate. A spider spins its web. These phenomena, in fact, everything in life, have their particular reasons. When it rains in our lives, it is because we need the rain in order to enjoy the sunshine and reap rich harvests. The way we meet all these phenomena, the way we master life, is our liberty of choice, mercifully granted by the Creator. The effect of every cause depends upon our reaction. Our soul grows as we overcome the trials and appreciate life's beauties and happy interludes. Oh yes, we can give vent to hatred and intolerance or despair, or we can deny these emotions which blind us to love and beauty and truth. And then we may acquire understanding instead of always seeking to have others understand us. No man can antedate his experience or guess what faculty or feeling a new object shall unlock, any more than he can draw today the face of a person he shall see tomorrow for the first time. So wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it's true, we're constantly learning new lessons. Often we find that what we have learned is that which we have failed to appreciate and to understand. Maturity often comes too late for us to profit by the lessons we should have learned earlier. But never too late for each of us to try to pass on to those who follow the lessons we finally understand. Life is a process of continual change and development as well as growth. But God's laws are never changing. To be happy, to make our lives satisfying, we must be flexible enough in mind and body and consciousness to accept changes when they come. Don't stubbornly resist all changes in your life and affairs. Make these changes yield the harvest of good that potentially lies in each one of us. This may be difficult, but let me tell you, you can do it if you will. You, as a matter of fact, and only you, can determine whether you are to be bowed down, crushed, steamrollered by the events of life, or overcome them and come out triumphant. A happy individual. That's your right if you apply God's basic laws. No matter how drastic changes in your life may seem, in your occupation, your place or mode of living, in your surrounding or associations or activities, or anything that concerns you, good is in this change for you. If you search hard enough to find it and accept it and make it your own by your reaction, by your adaptation to this change. Scenes and times and circumstances all come and go, but God is eternal and unchanging, and so is his law. His good is unfailing. What each of us needs is the deep personal conviction that this good exists in every circumstance. Then, no matter what may come, we can remain poised and serene, free from fear. When we are aware of and exercise the tremendous power of our minds to dominate circumstances, overcome obstacles and snags. A peaceful, contented, and satisfying life is within our grasp. You know, actually, we're really not alive except when fighting the perils that threaten the mind and soul. Life is a challenge, a wonderful challenge, a wonderful adventure. When there is no struggle, life degenerates into vegetable-like existence, inert, torpid, and decadent. It is the challenge of peril, physical, mental, or spiritual, that makes life vigorous and can make it triumphant. There are inevitable moments of our lives when a storm is as certain and as necessary as storms in the skies. There are other moments in which life's elements combine to give us a serene, perfect moment, when sun and temperature make the day electrically beautiful. We cannot prevent these extreme highs and lows that temper our soul, make them grow. We can only do our best and never relax our faith in God's mercy. Whatever experiences we meet on life's course, in order for our minds and souls to attain maximum growth, we must always hold firmly in mind life's basic analysis. And what is this? Well, life is composed of two parts. Keep this always in mind. Life is composed of two parts. The first part, beyond our individual control. Events, circumstances, situations, problems. And the second part, the part we can control, our reaction. The experiences we cannot control in no way prevent or limit our choice of reaction to these same experiences. Thus, in the end, our reactions, the second part of life, is much more important than any experience or situation or problem. Imagine an ocean dotted with coral islands, some small and some large, and washed by rising and outgoing tides. There you see a graphic illustration of our lives. The islands are the experiences we cannot avoid, the situations which sweep us away with joy or with sorrow, with happiness or anxiety. Before any man's life story is fully written, he must move from many of these coral islands to others. We cannot choose our individual islands of experience, but like the tide that flows against them, we can roll triumphantly over the coral rock, or we can break in many pieces. The way we move from one island of experience to another is ours to choose. Destiny provides the experiences we meet. We exert our own reactions. Do we wonder why life appears difficult at times? Do we wonder why there exists such reckless disregard for God's laws? Do we wonder why what seems evil appears to rage rampant in the world? We need not and should not be disheartened. There is no living thing in the world, plant or tree, fish or fowl, protoplasm or human being, without a place, a particular place, in the Creator's perfect plan. It is not necessary for each big or little entity endowed with life to be conscious of its own mission. It is sufficient to know there is no life, no spark of life without a purpose, no death without its role in the drama of life. Study the physical body. The answers to life's spiritual and intellectual cycles are clearly shown each day for our enlightenment. The body's marvels show how clearly sorrow and joy, pain and pleasure transform into part of a picture of growth. We begin our life in strife and struggle as we are born, and these conflicts continue until physical death. So sometimes you may feel that your load in life is too heavy for you to carry, that it is weightier than your strength and endurance can bear. Readjust your thinking. The strange thing about your load is it doesn't really bear down on your shoulders. It actually lifts you upwards. Imagine a load which lifts you upward. The life without a load is a life that goes down in defeat. Hear the fable of the small boy who read the story of Atlas, the titan who carried the world on his shoulders. The little boy imagined at first that Atlas must have been almost crushed under the weight of the world. But later, the youngster began to think in terms of Atlas's enormous strength. Only then did he begin to see that heavy loads must be wings that lift instead of crushing burdens. The small boy perhaps did not realize it, but growth was taking place within him. Soon the conscious physical reaction of the boy to his thought processes had him lifting the biggest stones he could find and carry. He tugged at paving stones and heavy wooden blocks, simply to pit his strength against them. And just like the boy, as we go through life, we learn no one can be really happy unless he carries a load. A human being fully lives only as he lifts. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the
All right, time for another installment of It's My House. And today, the title of our podcast is, could slave artisans have saved Yummy? And Yummy is the name of a young man, Richard Sandifer, nicknamed Yummy, Richard Yummy Sandifer, who made the cover of Time magazine when he was, of course, deceased, but he was only 11 years old. So we're going to take a look at his life, or at least part of it, and take a look at the slave artisans. And had he been aware of slave entrepreneurs and some of the mighty works of these artisans, maybe he could be living to this day. So we're going to that's what we're going to cover today. But before we do that, I think we're going to hear this speech here by Patton.
In July, we brought you a story about poverty in Alabama, which was spurred by a report from the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston. Alston toured America, spotlighting third world-style poverty in our first world country. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Simon Ostrowski continues following in Alston's footsteps with a report on poverty in Los Angeles. Supported in part by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, this report is part of our ongoing series about poverty and opportunity in America, Chasing the Dream.
Los Angeles, the home of some of the most desirable zip codes in the country. But right at the heart of this wealthy metropolis exist conditions that have been described by the city's own newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, as a national disgrace. One expanse of 50 city blocks is an area that's become synonymous with poverty, crime, and homelessness. It's existed for decades and has dogged successive mayoral administrations that have tried to eradicate it. It's called Skid Row, and is home to an estimated 2,000 members of Los Angeles County's homeless community.
L.A. has one of the highest rents in the nation. And the reason why come there's so many tents out here is because people can't afford to live in a house.
Steve Richardson, who goes by the name General Dogon, is an activist at the L.A. Community Action Network, which advocates for the city's homeless community.
The majority of the people that you see sleeping on the streets are black, and these are folks that have fell through the poverty level. It makes me really mad.
Long the subject of local and national concern, Skid Row recently garnered international attention when it became the focus of a report written by the United Nations Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, whose job more often involves assessing conditions in the developing world.
The homelessness on the streets in LA is pretty staggering in terms of magnitude, in terms of how long running it is. There is a chronic shortage of affordable housing.
Nationally, homelessness has been mostly on the decline since 2010, though it ticked upward slightly in 2017 to nearly 554,000 people without their own roof over their heads in a so-called point-in-time count. The Los Angeles area, meanwhile, has trended in the opposite direction, as the cost of living here soared over the last decade, forcing thousands onto the street in what has amounted to a nearly 50% increase in homelessness since 2012 to almost 53,000 people. The sheer size of Skid Row makes it look like a refugee camp. But according to a 2017 report by several homelessness advocacy groups, the availability of toilets here is worse than in a UN-run Syrian refugee camp.
It smells of urine everywhere. Skid Row had about 10 toilets, I think, for thousands of people. So it's a pretty bad setup.
So this is, call it the Big Green Machine. And it's a bathroom.
According to the LA Community Action Network, nearly 1,800 unsheltered people in Skid Row share access to just 9 toilets like this one, which means many avoid them altogether and use buckets, which are then emptied into the streets and trash cans.
And that was PTSD, but I didn't know nothing about that.
Willie Van Seals is a Vietnam vet suffering from heroin addiction, one of almost 3,900 homeless veterans in LA County.
I'll show you. The buckets that we use, urinate, bowel movement. There's nowhere around here to use the bathroom. And that's hard on a person. You know what I mean? Especially you got to walk around and find somewhere to take a crap. Yeah. Come on now.
The authorities know hygiene is an issue here. The county health department reported that its teams observed feces and urine on 8 of 10 sidewalks during a survey back in 2012. Street washes like this one have been instituted to help stop the spread of disease.
If we don't power wash the streets, we end up with what we had years ago when we had a tuberculosis outbreak or hepatitis outbreak or some kind of disease. It has to be done. It has to be done.
Officer Dion Joseph has been patrolling the streets of Skid Row for close to two decades. He says he's seen well-meaning policies to improve health conditions backfire.
Years ago, we had 27 porta potties in Skid Row. My concern was that they would be taken over by the criminal element. And day one, that's exactly what happened. When those bathrooms were here, gangsters were charging the homeless $1 to $5 to use the porta potties for what they were designed for.
While we're with him, Officer Joseph receives a complaint.
I've got these people who pulled up in front of the doorway. I've asked them repeatedly to move. And trying to have a rational conversation with the irrational people, I just don't want to do it.
How are you? I'm sorry to bother you. There's a gentleman here who has a business, and the law says you can't be within 10 feet of his doorway. Can you guys move about 10 feet this way so we can have his space?
He resolves the situation without incident. But the UN report points to data from the LA Times showing that 14,000 homeless people were arrested in LA in 2016, a 31% increase since 2011. The report encouraged authorities to shift from a criminal justice response to a human rights-centered response to homelessness.
Homelessness is being criminalized in many ways, and it's as though you sort of keep moving the pieces around the chessboard and suddenly it's going to improve. Instead of saying, okay, we actually need to work out how to create places where these people can go.
I agree with the UN. We shouldn't be the tip of the spear. Fix the system, especially in places like Skid Row, where many individuals struggle with dual diagnosis, where they're addicts and mentally ill. We don't want to be the tip of the spear, but we have to be until a solution's arrived.
According to Victor Hinderleiter of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, mental health and addiction are a huge factor contributing to homelessness.
Approximately 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a severe mental health disorder. About 30% of people experiencing homelessness self-report that they have a substance use disorder. Homelessness, in and of itself, is a traumatic experience.
Christina Miller, the LA Mayor's Senior Project Manager of Homeless Strategies, agrees that addressing homelessness is a multi-tiered process, but disagrees that the homeless are being criminalized.
And instead of leading with police, leading with enforcement, we are doing everything we can to lead with services, because we know that police officers are not social workers, and that it's not necessarily in their purview, and having an enforcement-heavy response is not ultimately going to get people off the streets.
Activists say they know what will get people off the streets.
The solution is simple. This is what the solution is. This is the only thing that ends homelessness, is this right here, house keys. And until everybody got them, hey, you got to be good neighbors, because there's going to be people sleeping on the streets.
There are a lot of solutions that we are focusing on currently in terms of trying to expand our interim shelter bed capacity. But we also know what the only solution is to homelessness, which is permanent housing.
Miller told NewsHour Weekend the city of LA had embarked on an unprecedented drive to build 10,000 units of housing for the chronically homeless, those who've repeatedly ended up on the streets or been there for at least a year. It's funded through a $1.2 billion city bond over the next 10 years. That's in addition to a $30 million bridge home program directed at providing interim housing in the meantime. And the efforts may have started to pay off. This year, the homeless count in LA County went down for the first time since 2014, only modestly, from 55,000 people to just under 53,000, but it bucks a six-year-long trend in the opposite direction.
We are cautiously optimistic. We are celebrating the fact that there seems to be a change in the direction of the trajectory, and it does tell us that we're doing something right.
Well, they were considerate enough to give us a pantry.
Jose Soto, another veteran, is one of the lucky ones who's recently been housed after years in and out of prison in Skid Row.
I'm really happy with the closet space, but
What do you fill it with?
Soto, who's in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, gave us a tour of the residence the city's provided to him free of charge.
I've been on and off the street for, 14 years. And in my situation, it was all due to substance abuse. I just like to get drunk a lot every day. And then before you know it, the lifestyle catches up and I'm one of the people on Skid Row or under a bridge.
Until newer housing comes online, homes like this are in very limited supply. Only veterans who've gone through a lengthy recovery process from substance abuse qualify for this building.
They treat us like trash.
For vet Willie Van Seals, who's still struggling with addiction, that seems like a distant prospect.
I went to the rehab.
Okay.
And when I went through, they promised me, when I got through, that they would actually give me my voucher and I could go and find me a place to stay.
Okay.
And none of that happened. Okay. This is where I ended up at.
So did you manage to kick the habit in rehab?
Nah.
America paints herself as a good Samaritan country. I'm glad the UN came here because you see third world conditions right here, you know, in the richest country in the world that's worse than other countries.
The United Nations report notwithstanding, there are other indications things may be improving for the homeless in LA. In 2016, Angelenos voted overwhelmingly for a tax increase directed at funding the creation of homes for the chronically homeless. And while tents still line the streets of Skid Row, this year, chronic homelessness has dropped 18% in L.A. County.
When it rains, you must have something on this floor.
But for Willie Van Seals and others like him, Los Angeles still has a long way to go.
Valerie, how did you learn that your boy had died?
Well, my daughter, first of all, she's on Facebook or whatever, and she saw the live streaming of the actual event. I, on the other hand, I didn't know what was going on. I just heard her screaming and hollering through the house, and I was like, what's going on? What's going on? And she was like, my brother's dying. My brother's been shot. Oh, my God. He's on Facebook. He's dying. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So I immediately jumped up, and we just headed out the door. And I'm like, where are they? Where are they? And we really couldn't get a fix on it until she said that it was a sign that stated Falcon Heights, you know, like a entry into that little area. And I said, no, I know exactly where I'm going. And we arrived on a scene, and it was cordoned off. And the police, you know, they were of really no assistance to me because, first of all, they didn't know where he was, what hospital, because I was adamant about being with my son because I did not want my son to die by himself.
Forgive me interrupting, but did you ever talk to your son about how to behave, if ever, in contact with the police?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really a shame that we as African-American people, we have to have that talk with our sons and our daughters as to if you're approached by the police, don't say anything, do exactly what they ask you to do, just comply, 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 because it has gotten to the point where this is a routine thing. Black people getting killed by a police officer, and there's no consequences. No one is held accountable. But I had that talk with my son. Yes, I did.
Right.
Now, often.
Let me just talk now to your lawyer for a moment. Judge Glenda Hatchett, you're going to fight this case. What real chance?
Absolutely.
What real chance is that there will be justice? And what chance is there even that there will even be a trial?
Well, let me first of all explain that I will not have the responsibility for prosecuting the police officers. I am representing the family on the civil side, but I am doing everything I can to urge that there be a special prosecutor on behalf of the family. I've already made those formal requests. We will be making a formal request to the Department of Justice with the U.S. Attorney General, because we want all eyes on this case. I have to explain that this is a man who was employed, who was loved by his family, adored by the community, who all of his coworkers, all of the children loved him. He had no felony record. He was not combative. He was not fleeing from the police. He was still in his seatbelt when he was shot. He was permitted to have, he had a legal permit to have a gun. And so if this happens to someone who is in full compliance, how can it possibly be justified? And I am going to do everything in my power to raise the level of consciousness and visibility on this case, and we are going to be insisting that the prosecutor proceed vigorously on this case. There
right.
is no other alternative.
Let me just come back to you in a moment, go back to Valerie. Valerie, you must have been buoyed by what you saw on the platform of the Democrat convention, because it seems that the Democratic Party and its candidate are determined somehow to rectify this desperate imbalance.
Yes, it needs to stop, because we cannot coexist with this type of behavior. There needs to be accountability. It just can't continue to go on like this, because you don't know how it's going to end. It may not end well, because you have, on the other hand, people who are supposed to protect and serve you, and they're the ones that's actually committing crimes legally. Mm-hmm. And it has to stop. There has to be accountability.
Right.
This type of behavior shouldn't be going on with our police officers.
Valerie, let me ask your judge friend, Glenda. Judge, what chance do you really think that the establishment, and you're talking to the establishment, you're talking to the Justice Department, what chance they will comply and provide a special prosecutor and answer the requests you're making?
Well, I am very hopeful. And the reason that I am representing the Castile family is because I hope to use the credibility that I have nationally, and I am going to vigorously pursue this. We have asked not only the local district attorney, we've asked the state attorney general and the governor, all in a very formalized request for a special prosecutor.
Right.
There is enough for the Justice Department to come in and do a separate investigation of practices.
Right.
And what we believe has been a history of profiling African-American citizens in
Judge,
this community.
Judge
so
Glenda
I operate from the side of hope, and we are going to work vigorously to make sure that this time
right.
is different.
Judge, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. And Valerie Castile, thank you very much. And commiserations, and may you reach
all
you.
Right.
Thank you very much.
This month, February, typically, well, nationally here in the United States, it's, a de facto month called Black History Month. And for us, we've been doing, our version of it is Black Towns History Month, also Slave Entrepreneur Month. So we've been featuring at least one person that was born a slave. I think we get every day we mention at least one. One day we got up to six. And then we mentioned some Jim Crow people in there too. But most of them were born slaves. Maybe one or two weren't. Today, and we'll pick out another one. I'll probably do a review of somebody I've done before. As we hinted yesterday, today's podcast is titled, Could Slave Artesian Saved Yummy? And who was Yummy? And once again, like every day, I've been going from Wikipedia. Yummy was the nickname or the strict street name. Well, I don't know if his mama gave it to him or he picked it up in the street. But in any event, Robert Sandifer, that's S-A-N-D-I-F-E-R, Sandifer, also known as Yummy, And why? Because according to his mother or his aunts, he just loved cookies. Nothing wrong with that for an 11-year-old or 111-year-old. Cookies, I love peanut butter cookies myself. In any event, let's read up on the late Robert Yummy Sandifer. And then I'm going to pick one slave entrepreneur and see if maybe had Robert Yummy Sandifer been aware of some slave entrepreneurs, maybe he would be living to this day. Anyway, I'm going for Wikipedia. Robert Yummy Sandifer was an 11-year-old American boy from Chicago, Illinois. His murder by fellow gang members in Chicago garnered national attention because of his age, resulting in his appearance on the cover of Time magazine in September 1994. Now, if you're on your computer, online, if you go to our Blog Talk Radio scrolling marquee, we do have pictures of Yummy, including the Time magazine cover that he made. But, of course, that was after his demise. Okay, I'm going to the main article here on Wikipedia. His murder by fellow gang members. Fellow gang members. Garnered national attention because of his age. Let's see. All right. Yummy, because of his love of cookies, let's get a visual on this. He's 11 years old. And he stood 4 feet 6 inches tall. Hardly a physical threat without weapons, because in these days and times you got to add in the weapons. But alone, without any weapons, he stood, 4 foot 6. Sandifer was a young member of the Chicago street gang, the Black Disciples. Now, let's get into the Black Disciples. We're coming back to Yummy, but we want to put this all out there. I mean, what is an 11-year-old? How did he become a member of a street gang? Well, the street gang was the Black Disciples. So let's get a little bit of information on him. Them, and I'm going from them, Wikipedia as well. It was the Black Disciples was formed in 1966, 56 years ago. It was founded by David Barksdale. It's active to this day. The territory that they call territory is Chicago, Illinois. The ethnicity of the group, they have African American. What's interesting about it? This is a comedian. He's late, too. Ralphie May. He says, why don't African American or black folk get a more accurate description to identify themselves, because most people that identify as African-American have never been to Africa. And he was saying, like Chicago Americans. Because this guy Yummy, although he was identified as African-American, more than likely Yummy didn't venture too much further outside of the boundaries of the city of Chicago. Never went to Africa. Anyway, that's a whole different podcast on identity. Membership of the Black Disciples, anywhere from 9,000 to 12,000 people. And Chicago's got like over 1 million black people, over 3 million people within the city limits. All right, now, more background on the Black Disciples. It was founded by a guy named David Barksdale. So let's Let's get into David Barksdale. David Barksdale was born on May 24th, 1947. Oh, man, that's 10 years before me. All right, in Salis, Mississippi. He died on September the 2nd, 1974, at 27 years old in Chicago, Illinois. He's buried in Slip, Illinois. And he's known for being a street gang leader. He was married and had three children. Okay, now, biography. Born Donice David Barksdale in Salis, Mississippi, the parents of Virginia and Charlie Barksdale, he was the 10th of 13 children. His family moved to Chicago, Illinois, in 1957. Within three years of arriving in Chicago, Barksdale had become a notorious gang leader. Should have stayed in Mississippi, but that's another podcast, too. In 1972, Barksdale's gang absorbed several others and became known as the Black Disciple Nation. Tensions grew between the Black Disciples and other gangs, such as the Blackstone Rangers. In 1968, the leader of the Black Peacestone Nation, Eugene Harrison, ordered a hit on Barksdale, which resulted in Barksdale being shot 7 times while sitting in his car in May of that year. Barksdale was shot in the abdomen while exiting a bar in the Englewood neighborhood of Chicago one night in June 1970. He survived and continued running the gang while Harrison was sent to prison and eventually killed for trying to organize his murder. Barksdale eventually grew sick of the bloodshed and proposed a merger with Larry Hoover, the founder of the Gangster Disciples, in 1973. Hoover accepted, and the Black Gangster Disciple Nation was born. Over the course of his life, Barksdale was arrested 25 times but never convicted of any serious offense. On several occasions, he was arrested. He used the alias David Jones, Death and Legacy. On September the 2nd, 1974, Barksdale died from kidney failure as a result of the June 1970 attack in which there was an attempt on his life by members of the Black Peacestone Rangers armed with M14 rifles outside of a bar Barksdale was frequenting with Larry Hoover at 848 West 69th Street. The assassination attempt ended the truce that was in place at the time. He was survived by his three children, David, Melinda, and Ronnie Barksdale, one of whom was gunned down by a member of the Gangster Disciples street gang in 1996. His wife, Yvonne Barksdale, she was murdered 3 years later on June 1977. Barksdale is still revered by the Black Disciples. Every year there is a birthday celebration in his honor. In 2008, there was a parade that was sponsored and supported by the Black Disciples organization. In a controversial move registered by the Chicago City Council for the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend. The parade was criticized by the Fraternal Order of Police, and officers administering the event were forewarned about potential gang violence. All right, so Barksdale, and there's a picture of him on Wikipedia. He transitioned at 27, but he started the group that eventually took in Robert Yummy Sandiford, who Yummy only made it to 11. All right, let's get back to Yummy. All right, now, let's see. He stood 4'6". Sandiford was a young member of the Chicago Street Fraternity of the Disciples. Now, after committing murder, arson, and armed robbery, he was now, I'm going to read this again. After, in the right context, after Yummy, the 11-year-old, after he had committed a murder, after he had committed arson, after this 11-year-old committed a robbery, he was murdered by his own fellow gang members who feared he can become an informant, aka street language snitch, and that he was attracting too much attention towards their activities because he was doing all this craziness. All right. Coverage of Sanford's death and retrospectives of his short, violent life were widely published in the American media. Sanford became the symbol of the gang problem in American inner cities. The failure of society's safety nets and the shortcomings of the juvenile justice system. Let's get into some background on Yummy. Robert Sanford, also known as Yummy, was born in Chicago on March 12, 1983. Sanford's mother, Lorena Sanford, had over 30 arrests herself for prostituting, many of which were drug-related. So he was, that's who he was born to. All right. No judgment. I'm just, that's what he was born into. All right. Sanford's father, Robert Atkins, was absent throughout Sanford's life due to incarceration for felony gun charge. Sanford was physically abused from the time he was an infant. So basically, somebody was creating a monster. It takes a village. It takes a village to create monsters as well. Anyway, before he was 3 years old, Sanford was already known to the Department of Children and Family Services. Here's the thing. There's a whole lot of Yummies. In every major city, there's a whole lot of Yummies. Physical examination showed that Sanford was alleged to have had cigarette burns. That reminds me that when, you know, on Good Times, you know, the episodes when they first brought Janet Jackson on as Penny. Anyway, on his alleged they had cigarette burns on his arms, neck, as well as linear bruising, consistent with physical beatings. Lorena, his mother, initially blamed the abuse on Sanford's father, although she later recanted. In 1968, Sanford and his siblings were removed from his mother's home by DCFS, Department of Children and, children's thing, and they were sent to live with the grandmother in the Roseland neighborhood of Chicago. His grandmother's residence contained as many as 19 children on some occasions, by most a dumping ground. Anyway, by most accounts, his grandmother's home was not much better than Sanford's previous home. Sanford, by the age of 8, quit attending school. Now, that's third grade. And began to roam the streets, stealing cars and breaking into houses. At the age of 10, Sanford was arrested on the charges of armed robbery. A psychological examination at the time reported that Robert is a child growing up without any encouragement and support, and that he has a sense of failure that has infiltrated almost every aspect of his inner self. Now, just by reading these few passages, I'm no board-certified psychologist or psychiatrist, but I'm thinking that this guy, because he only lived to be 11, he was looking for some type of guidance and love, but looking for some type of guidance, and he found it, or what he thought was guidance, and it was negative guidance, I mean bad, was at this with this street gang, which that's probably the story of every last person that, well, almost every last person that, I'm sure there's some exceptions. Some people that probably were brought up in good two-parent households, but for some reason, they're just fascinated with thug life. You got that element, too. All right. The murder of Siobhan Dean. On August 28, 1994, Sanford, was I in Detroit at that time? Well, a year later. Sanford was, oh, but I was in Detroit, though, not Chicago. Anyway, Sanford was ordered to do a favor for the gang. So, once again, looking for guidance, looking for validation, looking for approval. One of his fellow gang members asks him, well, I'll read it. He was ordered to do a favor for the gang at 11. He opened fire several times with a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, striking several youths. Sandiford quickly fled the scene. Among his victims was a 14-year-old girl, Siobhan Dean, who was fatally hit by a stray bullet. Yummy's death. On August 31st, while standing on a neighbor's porch and asking to call his grandmother, whom he had the greatest trust, Sandiford was met by brothers Greg and Derek Hardaway, ages 14. And six, I mean, excuse me, after ages 14 and 16, three train wrecks are about to collide. Because the 14-year-old, he had two brothers. The 14-year-old has a big brother who's 16, so I guess it's monkey see or monkey do with that one. And, man, we're talking about no guidance all the way around. All right. Now, mind you, Derek and Craig Hardaway and Yummy Sandiford were all in the same gang. Sandiford was told he was being taken to a safe location and ordered into a waiting car. So here's just, hey, this is an 11-year-old looking up to fellow gang members who are 14 and 16. You know, he's trusting these guys. To him, they're his big brothers. Big brothers that he never had. That's the way he was probably looking at it. So he went on and he got in the waiting car. You know, at 11, man, you only got so many. You don't have a whole lot of life experiences under your belt yet. He went on, you know, somebody asked him to shoot, he shot. He was trying to get validation. He was trying to get guidance. Sandiford was shot. All right, wait. Instead of being taken to the railroad underpass at East 108th Street and South DuPont, or Dufresne, whatever, I might be butchering that name, Chicago Avenue, he was told to get on his knees. While kneeling, Sandiford was shot twice in the back of the head by the Hardaway brothers. Sandiford's body was discovered by the Chicago Police Department in the early morning, September the 1st. So here's a little guy, 4'6", unarmed at the time of his death, and he just willingly went along, got in the car, because more than likely, Dad, no judgment on Dad, he might have been incarcerated at the time. So he couldn't have been there. But the damage was done way before 11 years old. Anyway, around 400 people attended Yummy Sanford's funeral, and I've got some. I got two of those pictures on the scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio, which was held at the Youth Center Church of God in Christ on Chicago's northwest side. The Hardaway brothers, and there's video on these guys on YouTube, as well as Yummy. The Hardaway brothers were later convicted of Sanford's murder. Derek Sanford, age 14 at the time of Sanford's murder, received a sentence of 20 years. He was released in December of 2016. Now, how could a slave artisan possibly save Yummy's life? I'm going to pick two people for this one. I'm trying to find, well, let's see. Let's go with I don't want to talk about the guy from yesterday. All right. Well, since this happened in Illinois, let's start with Frank McWhorter, who I've covered on here before, also known as Free Frank McWhorter, born a slave, and let's see, Fred McWhorter. I'm trying to get his profession. But Frank McWhorter bought 40 acres. And, well, here's the thing. With Fred McWhorter and all these artisans, all of them had some type of skill set. Carpentry, furniture makers, what have you. Frank McWhorter, Free Frank McWhorter, McWhorter with a W, he bought about 80 acres of land. He started his own town. And I'm sure, because he didn't start it solo. I mean, you know, the money was his to buy the acres of land. But I'm sure he was artisan as well as people that helped him found that town, you know, putting up the first church building, put up the first building, you know, housing, accommodations, all that. These people had skills. They had skill sets. Let's see. Here we go. Okay, Fred. Oh, you know what I'm putting it. It's Frank, people. I don't know why I keep on saying Fred. Frank McWhorter. Okay, Free Frank McWhorter. And let's read up about him. I'm going out on a limb here, but I would say easily probably one of the primary reasons why a lot of these guys join the gang is, number one, they're not getting any guidance, a positive guidance from male authority figures in the home. That's where you got to start off with. Number two, you know how little boys, they like to imitate big brother or dad. So they don't know anything, you know, they know about carjacking, but did anybody sit down and say, look, let's teach you something about auto mechanics? They're looking for some type of guidance, and they fall into this. Sorry, biography. Frank McWhorter, born 1777 into slavery in South Carolina, to Judah, born in West Africa, abducted into slavery and transported to the colony. His father was likely a white enslaver. George McWhorter, of Scottish and Irish planter, according to his family tradition. Judah, his mother, I guess, to convince McWhorter to allow his mixed-race son to live. Ooh, that's rough, man. All right. In 1795, McWhorter moved to Pulaski County, Kentucky, and took Frank to build and later manage his holdings there. What do you call that type of person there? His broker? Okay. Frank tended to the farm, but McWhorter also leased them to work for neighbors as a laborer. By being hired out, Frank learned business skills and earned more money than his master required of him to hand over. After McWhorter moved to Tennessee, he continued to have Frank manage his farm in Kentucky. So the guy knew about farming. I almost want to say ranching. Frank used his savings to create a saltpeter production operation for which there was considerable demand during the War of 1812. Okay, in 1799, Frank married Lucy, an enslaved African-American, on the neighboring plantation. They had 13 children born into slavery, of whom four, Judah, Frank, Sally, and Solomon, survived. By 1817, Frank had earned enough money to buy Lucy from her master for $800. She was pregnant at the time, her son Squire, and she... See, Yummy, you know, I'm just speculating. Yummy wasn't next to none of this. You know, Yummy, you know what? Let's take something as simple as arts and craft. You know, how to make a kite. You know. Did he know how to even make? I remember when I was that age, man. I was sitting up in class, you know, and I was in a private school, and we're making pop guns made out of paper. We're making kites. We're making airplanes, that type of stuff. And then, you know, I was in the Cub Scouts for a little bit, and about two years probably. Have dem meetings on Saturday mornings. You know, you got a book there, and you know, you're making projects, arts and craft projects, you know, that are in the book, you know, birdhouses, things of that nature. Anyway, back to Frank McWhorter. In 1830, Frank McWhorter, Lucy, his wife, and their four children, moved to Pike County, Illinois. By the second year, they started farming. You know, Yummy might have, hey, man, Yummy, let's go. I'm going to teach you how to grow tomatoes. In 1836, Frank filed a plat to create the village of New Philadelphia on 80 acres, which he had purchased from the federal government for $100. Town site, which had divided into, somebody like Frank McWhorter, I believe, could have saved Yummy. Now, they didn't leave at the, in the same time period, but had somebody at home known about Frank McWhorter. Maybe they did. I don't know. I don't know his people. You know, when he was going to school, because he dropped out at 8. That's third grade. And we know for sure nobody in the gang told him about, in this very state of Illinois, there was a guy who was born a slave that he started his own town on 80 acres that he purchased. Gang activities don't include buying 80 acres. And it's amazing how they say, well, this is our corner, and that's our you don't own shit. I'm just speculating here. I'm just speculating. But anyway, Frank McWhorter, that's the, there are others, there are hundreds, there are thousands of us during slavery days and even Jim Crow that I believe had Yummy and most of those gang members could have redirected their energy. Even when it comes to gunplay, you know, teaching them how to hunt. Hunt for game, though. You know, rabbits, deers, what, you know, whatever you want to, you know. You know, had he ever been camping before? Because a lot of, you know, a lot of your people on, you know, during the Underground Railroad, you know, they had to camp. They had to know how to camp. So I don't know the academic, other than what they have on Wikipedia. He dropped out of school at 8 years old. That would put him in third grade. That's still a very young eight. But, hey, man, I remember when I was, like I said, I was in the Cub Scouts doing arts and craft assignments. During the summertime, I was at overnight camps and day camps, arts and crafts assignments, fishing, archery, boating, canoeing, rowboating, telling stories, Hatchet Harriet and Bloody Mary around a campfire, roast, stuff like that. That's what I was doing at 8. So I really appreciate my mother doing that. However, Yummy wasn't as fortunate. But the amazing thing is Chicago is rich in Black history. Plenty of examples. I mean, at the time that of Yummy's demise, okay, you had, matter of fact, one of my favorite biographies to read is Succeeding Against the Odds by John H. Johnson. John H. Johnson started the Negro Digest. And then that morphed into Ebony and Jet magazine and the Ebony Fashion Fair, and I think Ebony's online today, you know, the Beauty of the Week and the hot, you know, most popular records in the back of the Jet magazine. And him and Berry Gordy, I think, were the first two blacks in this country to make the Forbes 400. But he was alive and living in Chicago during the lifetime of Yummy. Louis Farrakhan lives in Chicago at the lifetime of Yummy. Jesse Jackson. George Johnson, who was married to, I think he's still living, his wife Joan Johnson of Johnson Products, the Afro Sheen blowout kit and Afro Sheen products and Johnson hair care products and all that. That's George Johnson. And George Johnson bankrolled Soul Train. he was living at the time Yami was alive. And then you have, I think it's either Travis Dempsey a real estate tycoon, black man, in Chicago. All these guys in Chicago during the lifetime of Yami. Somebody mentioned yesterday, I believe, Brother Beasley, Marvin Collins, her school, Westside Prep, opened during the lifetime of Yami. All up there in Chicago. And I'm sure there are a gazillion other people. That's just, you know, I'm just thinking that's just off the top of my head. So there were plenty of positive black examples, but although they were in close proximity of Yami, as well as 9,000 other gang members in that city, just one gang, Yami at 11 and the Hardaway brothers, 14 and 16 at the time, apparently, I'm just speculating, I don't know, I can't prove it, that these gentlemen did not know about these people I just named. And they knew nothing about the slave artisans. And maybe they didn't even know that Chicago was discovered, or not discovered, I hate that word, maybe first settled by DuSable, which there's a high school named after him in Chicago as well. And, I mean, hey, Chicago, the original Soul Train, home base, Chicago, before they went out to California. Don Cornelius, Chicago. And then if we get into music, and I think Ramsey, I mean, Chicago has produced quite a few positive people, but unfortunately, it appears that Yami, I mean, there's only so much you can do at 11, man. I mean, he couldn't have gone out and gotten a job to support himself. He was only 11, and he was only 4'6". And he got, you know what? Apparently, he wasn't even on the radar that much because he dropped out of school in third grade. I'll see if I can find some people that can give more details on Yami, but my opinion had, because some people, I mean, identity, as Beasley points out, is very important. Just to see it, to see somebody do something, you know, somebody that looks like you doing something successful, that can, you know, help out a whole lot of people. I'll give you my take on that. For instance, I think when Barack Obama was first elected, no matter what you think about Obama, just on the strength of him winning, you have hundreds, if not thousands of people, both black, white, yellow, green, purple, blue, or brown in this country, that for the first 8 years of their life, it was normal for them to see a black man and a black family in the power position of President of the United States. There are thousands of people, regardless of color, race, religion, it's normal to them. I think that's the big, him getting elected, you don't need to do nothing else. Just that identity. By him getting elected, then other people more than likely stop using the excuse of, I can't do this, I can't do that. In other words, they looked at him and said, you know what? If he can do that, I can do this. I think, matter of fact, I think that's why Trump ran for president. I'm just theorizing now. I don't know Trump. But Trump probably said, you know what, wait a minute. If he can run for president, then I can run for president, and I might have a shot. And it worked. Because Trump never even ran for dog catcher before. He ran for political. That was his first time, to my knowledge, running for political office, and he ran. And he won. After Obama did two terms. So who did Yummy, the people, the images that he had, because once again, now I'm just speculating, he was looking for guidance, he was looking for validation. And the people that were in close proximity to him were these gang members who obviously there was no loyalty because two gang members took him out. Two people that he did trust. Two of his big brothers, 114. And the age difference between 11 and 14, that's a big age gap at those ages. And the other brother was 16. I like, so you can go on, what do you call it, YouTube, and it's quite a bit of information, you know, two videos on that. The two brothers who were, well, one's got been released from prison. But there's a whole lot of yummies. There are yummies in Cleveland, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Seattle, D.C., you know, Miami, Dallas, Houston. There's a yummy. They're yummies all over the United States. Young kids, you can throw in females too. They're not getting any guidance at home. They're not getting any validation at home. They're not getting any positive identification at home, so they go seek it somewhere else. On the history part, particularly there in Chicago, I mean, 11 years old, man, you need to be doing field trips to the museum. Chicago's got them. 45 minutes to an hour away from Chicago, depending on the traffic, there's Pembroke, Illinois, and Hopkins Park, Illinois. Hopkins Park, in particular, is a black township. Still exists. You know, like a 45-minute to, you're getting completely out of the city. It's very rural. Very rural. You know, I didn't see that much traffic when I was there. You know, it's the type of place where you can call the mayor, man, and you can have a convo with the mayor and say, Mr. Mayor, look, I got a bunch of 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, and 10-year-olds. We want to take a trip down there. You know, could you suggest somebody that can give us, you know, a tour of Hopkins Park and Pembroke? Because it was also part of the Underground Railroad that ran through there, too. So you can make this into a learning lesson. Where you can include science and history. Because they built their own houses. They grew their own food. You still have a lot of people that do agriculture down there. You got black folks that own 40 acres of land, 80 acres of land, 75 acres. That's black. Expose people like Yummy to people like that that are in Pembroke, Illinois, and Hopkins Park, Illinois, right now? And then imagine that that's a day field trip. They're not hearing no police sirens, ambulance sirens. You know, it's quiet. Matter of fact, I was only there for about, what, 3-4 hours. I didn't see not one cop car. I didn't see no police when I was there. I was only there for a few hours. You know, because I flew up from Florida and then flew back that night. But I'm just saying. You know, so, you know, that's a little short field trip. And it's a fascinating history of Hopkins Park. The families, it was two families that walked from North Carolina to Illinois. They had maybe one or two Conestoga wagons, some, you know, maybe a couple of horses or whatever. One family had, what, about 13 kids? They walked from North Carolina to Illinois, bought 40 acres of land, and it's up there right now, Hopkins Park, Illinois, which is a little village within Pembroke, Illinois. So you can throw in lessons about, you know, the Underground Railroad and different aspects of history and, you know, just what a 45-minute, 2-hour drive from Chicago. To get them out of that environment of toxicity. So that's my take on it. To answer the question, could slave artisans have saved Yummy? I believe so. But you got to expose them as young as possible. Although I believe you can take somebody of any age that are not, you know, that are not familiar with some of these artisans, and you know, I mean, somebody like Yummy really deserved, you know, overnight camping. Anyway, that's my take on it. All right, we're going to take this a short interlude. We're going to go to the phone lines right after this.
A lot of pills. But I've never touched nothing that my spirit could kill. You know I've seen a lot of people walking around with tombstones in their eyes. God damn, the pusher. Thank you.
with a love breath in his hand. Oh, but the butcher is a monster. Good God, he's not a natural man. The dealer for Nickelodeon sell you lots of sweet dreams. Ah, about the pusher on your body. Love will leave your mind to dream. God damn. Ah, the pusher.
Yummy Sandifer, that's S-A-N-D-I-F-E-R, Yummy Sandifer story, September 1994. It's I'm gonna watch it this afternoon. It's about 49 minute piece on YouTube. In any event, question of the day: could slave artisans save Yummy? Had he been, well, two-step approach on this. Had he been not only aware of them, but had he been, well, you know, just the example I just gave. Okay. Take him on a field trip, because, like I said, you go from Chicago to Hopkins Park, it's a totally different world. totally different world. Compton's Park in Pembroke, Illinois is quiet. It's rural. You meet black people down there that grow things. Black people who own 40 or 40 more or more acres of land. There's no big deal down that way. I don't think you're going to see no of those people down in Pembroke or Hopkins Park. There's nothing for a family to own 20, 15. I talked to one lady, I think she and her husband, they had 75 acres of land. So it's no big deal for to see a black person in that neck. Matter of fact, you know what? The time I was down, now I'm sure there was some living with it. That I didn't see him. Everybody that I saw black that day in Hopkins Park Pembroke, they were black. Now, I understand you got some Hispanics down there, but everybody that I saw and the people I've talked to that have land for rent and sale have all been black. I'm just saying. Okay, I'm sure there's some white people somewhere down there. But, you know, just a field trip. You know, they can do, you know, just to get out of the city, man. Do some arts and craft. You know, teach them how to make a kite or a fishing rod or how to make a broom. I think those activities possibly could have helped save him. Anyway, but he's just one among many because cities like Chicago, Boston, any city of any size, you know, if you don't catch those kids early enough, then other forces can step in and they'll guide them. 3:14, your mic is open.
Well, how are you, D.L.E.?
I can't complain. I made a trip to the hardware store and bought me a new toy today.
I hope it was a hammer.
No,
but
I got one of those.
That's your business, not mine.
Okay.
But these stories are kind of are sad.
Mm-hmm.
But real.
Very real.
People don't try it, everything. Talks. You're absolutely right. Or teasing, that being someone who has some special skills. Not
right.
To be special, but somebody to have a sharing heart. Probably would have made a difference for the young man.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't care for somebody's child more than the parents, the family care for them themselves.
You're absolutely right.
And I'm sure they all come out during the funeral, but where was that camaraderie before?
Exactly. Right. And I got a scrolling marquee up there. They have, because he had an open casket. And you had one picture with some, you know, young kids, you know, they were touching his face and all that. Guess they probably never seen a dead person before. I don't know. But,
Well, a dead anything brings about a curiosity.
Right.
From who's ever alive. Whether it's a dead rat, people, they take sticks and poke at it and turn it over and stuff like that. Or a dead bird.
Mm-hmm.
And dead human. Of course, depends on where you are. Some cannibals eat humans. But, you know, that's in their culture. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing
well,
with
there
animals.
Are a lot of yummies. There were yummies before Yummy. His story just happened to make it to Time Magazine. But there's still yummies to this day. They're being, you know, they're being made every day.
Well, yeah, in Chicago.
Chicago, Seattle.
Is that where he was? He was in Chicago, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was in Chicago.
Chicago in the last 267 days as of February the 22nd from Memorial Day of last year. They only had 3,699 people shot with 508 murders.
Now, I've never been in a street gang or nothing like that, but I'm just throwing that out there. Now, I'm assuming one of maybe I need to find a gang member or a former gang member to have him on here one day. I'm figuring one of the reasons why a lot of these kids join these gangs is they're looking for a sense of belonging, and they're searching for, and as Breezy would say, an identity. So the Black Disciples and whatever logo that they have, I don't know what kind of, I got to look up what kind of, if they have jackets or whatever. But I'm looking at it, that's probably their identity.
Well, it can't be all these shootings going on 3,700. Being
that's
members of a gang, because you got 30, that'd be 7,400 people total.
Right.
And the gangs ain't that big. Somebody getting shot, somebody shooting them. 7,400. Of course, it won't stop there because we still got till May when my count stopped. I don't know if I'm going to do another year count. And 600 south, some odd people. 508 people getting murdered. So that would be 1,016. So you got some people that's just killing folks. Something wrong with these people. I keep telling you, these people, some of these people are cursed. Intergenerational curse.
My mother made that statement a couple times when she was living.
I used to hear that, but I didn't want to believe.
If you don't expose. All right, I'm not a parent, but I work with a guy once in D.C., in the D.C. school system. His name was Andrew Trent. He said, you got to let these kids know who's boss when you bring them home for the hospital. I agree with him 100%. So apparently that didn't happen with Yummy. Cause Yummy's just,
well, you know.
Yeah.
No, it didn't. And then you had a video, audio recording earlier. Well, you had the woman talking about we as African Americans have to. Well, when she say that we as, who in the heck is she talking about? Then she made mention saying that it's a routine thing that white police officers kill blacks. She says it is a routine thing blacks. Well, I'm saying that it's a routine thing that. Blacks, more so than anybody else, don't comply.
True.
Then she made some remark about Democrats at the convention, as if Republicans support bad policing. That's what she was making points on. So that there is a problem, too, because I told you, down there in Louisiana, when that barber, that black barber, was running from the highway patrol in a high-speed chase, somewhere along the line in the story, he was told that all white police wants to kill him. In St. Louis, and I dare you to look this up on Google, the NAACP put out a travel advisory and saying that if you drive through Missouri, you stand a chance of being killed by white police. Now, that is just deplorable. That is totally, totally deplorable. To put out a travel advisory and say that if you travel through Missouri, you stand a chance of being killed by white police. Now, if you're going to have accountability on one side, you want the police to have accountability. Well, you got to have accountability with the citizenship that they interact with. And then again, you need to really hold these organizations, foster this type of feelings, rhetoric, from the news on down to the organizations like I just mentioned, because they're causing a problem. They're instigating. Just like Maxine Waters. Huh?
Yeah, you're right. Maxine Waters came up from L.A., California, to Minnesota during the George Floyd thing.
So everything is just screwed up. I don't know what to tell you, but it's all screwed up. And I really think what you said, too, when you said that people should identify rather than
these kids are, I mean, they like some people want to, I remember when I was in the D.C. school system, you had some kids, they didn't care about doing classwork or nothing, academics, but the reason why they came to school, not all of them, but quite a few of them, they came to school and they looked forward and they gave their most respect to the instructor that was, we called him Sarge. They wanted to go in ROTC because they identified with the Army, Navy, whatever branch of the, you know, service that they wanted to go into. So I'm just assuming, until I get a gang or former gang member on here, is that Yummy and the two guys who killed Yummy, they all wanted to be gangster disciples.
Well, I wasn't kind of referring like
that. And that was part of their identity.
What you made mention of, like this woman say, we as. People say, why is blacks killing each other? Well, then, why don't you say, why are black Chicagoans killing each other? You follow me? Why is blacks in North St. Louis killing each other? Because all blacks are not doing that.
Yeah, well, true. But you do have, like, all right, Yummy was 11. You do have a lot of Yummies before Yummy, during Yummy, and after Yummy that are in Dallas, Houston, Seattle, Washington, Brooklyn, New York, that they're looking for guidance.
How old was Yummy? 11?
Yummy was 11 years old when he met his maker.
Well, shit. We had one here in St. Louis that was 10. Carjacking. We had another one in St. Louis. You can look it up on Google. 11 years old, him and his mama. You're supposed to get guidance from your parents, right? Him and his mama carjacked the man. She got the man in the letter. Him in the car.
Right.
Hang on for a second. She got the man to let him in the car. She got in the front seat. The 11-year-old got in the back seat. The man pulls off. Before you know it, the 11-year-old is pistol-whipping the man upside the head with a gun.
And more than likely, he got that guidance. And he was just hold on, Pianca. Let me go to another person here. Because we're in overtime. 346, your mic is open.
Yeah, good morning, L.A. How you doing this morning?
Good morning, Houston. I mean, Warren, it's good to
see you.
Good morning, Pianchi. I enjoyed the response that you gave this morning on Naima Latif's show. What am I missing? What did I miss here on This My House today? What are y'all hear y'all talking about?
We're talking about the title is Could Slave Artisans Have Saved Yummy? I've been doing a whole black or slave entrepreneur thing all this month. And our artisans, you know, people that made brooms, ships, boats, houses, carpenters, all that. So Yummy, Richard Yummy Sandifer, was an 11-year-old, and there's a bunch of videos about him online in a Wikipedia article. He was killed at 11 years old by two of his gang members of the Black Disciples.
Right.
And Yummy himself had killed somebody like a day or two before that.
Okay, so I'm familiar with who he is and what happened. So what is the question now?
Well, could slave artisans, I'll use a higher profile, we all know about George Washington Carver. Had he been exposed to a George Washington Carver, would he have taken an interest in science or biology? Had people taken him out of Chicago, and taking them to Hopkins Park, Illinois, about an hour away. And, you know, had Yummy ever been on a farm before?
Well, you know, most
people. So the question is, could somebody from slave days who was successful been, had he learned about these people, could it change his, turned his life around? That's the question.
Well, most people are products of their environment. Some people, it just depends on the willpower from within. My mentor, who's been practicing law in the city of Houston for over 30 years, very well-to-do. He's from Montgomery, Alabama. I'll never forget when he first took me home, when he showed me the little one-room shack he grew up in, my mouth dropped because there's nothing about him that you can look at him that says this is what he came out of. It didn't even have a restroom in it. Same thing with me. I grew up in the Fifth Ward area. I grew up around pimps, dope pushers, crack, cocaine, all of that. But I could have went the way of Fifth Ward or the things that I was around. I made a decision to change myself. So it all depends on the willpower of a person. Everybody's inner system is different as to how they view the world and how they react to it. But you automatically, when you put a person in a situation like that, they automatically set up for failure. So it takes a person with willpower at that point to go past failure.
Well, I agree with you with that, but this guy was like he was 11 when he died.
Right, right. Well, he's a product of his environment. This is the stuff that he was around.
Oh, yeah, his environment
wasn't good
at all.
Exposed to, you know. You know, they're high impressionable as 11 years old, very impressionable as far as to what you can show them.
Right. Right, because he had killed, I guess it was part of the gang initiation. You know, somebody put a gun in his hand, and he was shooting out there while he hit some people, and the person that he killed, she was hit by a ricochet bullet that he had fired. So then the two guys, two other gang members, 114, 116, they're the two people that took him out. Now, they got arrested like the next day. I don't know the details on that because somebody within the gang could have snitched him out. I don't know. One's been released and one still might be in prison. But you're right, 11 years
old
is a very impressionable age.
You know what? That stuff does go on. They use the gang or whoever used them to kill him to get them out of the way too. You got the same thing. If you got a family member that's just totally ridiculous, they sacrifice him to a police killer so they can get a settlement.
Good point. Pawns.
You know,
wipe off the board.
I guess it's the mindset of, it's like right now, Houston is supposed to be, crime so bad here in Houston, we're supposed to be doing past Chicago right about now in crime.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it from a day-to-day. I look at the news, I see it, but from, you know, I don't see it from a day-to-day standpoint of basis, you know, but I'm always on guard because you never know. But my focus is not even on that, even though everybody's talking about how bad crime in Houston is right now. My focus is not there. So it's just the mentality or the mindset that you have, and anybody can overcome
now,
their environment.
Warren, you teach school occasionally. What are the ages of the students that you teach when you teach them?
Well, I've taught them all, elementary, middle school, and high school, but I after teaching all of them, I got away from elementary school. Elementary school was too much of a headache for me. I couldn't deal with it. So I stuck with the junior high and the high school.
Now, that's the junior high that I didn't like.
It just all depends because it looked like the older that they got, the more you could deal with them. It looked like high school kids were much more easier to deal with than even the junior high school. But then sometimes I ran into some issues at the high school where I thought I was going to have to snatch somebody and manhandle them, you know.
Right.
But
you can't do that these days, though. And get away with it. No, junior high was pretty crazy.
Teaching, no salary pays me enough to allow a student to put their hands on me. No salary.
Well,
but I look at the school as part of the prison, the pipeline industry, because it's been broken down to where there's no prayer in school, there's no discipline in schools, there's literally no consequences for bad actors. So you have no control, you know, of the students.
That,
and if you don't have any control of the students, you can't teach them.
That, I agree. I think a big part of the problem why you got some of these kids that come to school and act up, such as Yummy or whatever, is these kids come to school. Imagine now, Yummy. He passed away at 11. Now they said his mother got arrested for prostitution at least 30 times. So imagine this guy's getting up because he dropped out of school in eighth grade. I mean, no, not eighth grade, when he was 8 years old. That's what, third grade? So imagine if, you know, Yummy comes home from school or wakes up in the morning and there's a revolving door going in and out of his mother's bedroom. That's a traumatic thing for an eight-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking a lot of kids that act up in school, particularly I didn't like the middle school people at all. They got PTSD, but they're not getting any counseling. I'm not a counselor, but I'm just saying. So,
it definitely starts at home, whatever the situation,
right,
that it stems from the home. But that still, in a sense, should not give the states the right to further break down the school system, because there are other children that are in those same environments that would push through or could benefit when you got somebody destroying the whole classroom. Now, do they need counseling or do they need some type of help assistance? Maybe so. But if there's no consequences, behind their actions, then it's just going to continue to happen. Right now, all over America, public schools, especially in the black community, have become a joke. It looks like they're shutting down all the public schools in the black communities.
Well, ain't nobody there, Warren. You go there in St. Louis, the population in the public schools is down to 22,000. I remember when it was 100,000. In Detroit, down to 50,000, less than 50,000. I remember when it was over 100,000 with a $1 billion budget. People move.
Yeah.
That's what the thing is. And I hear folks complain, well, we need some black male teachers. Well, like you, black males ain't going to want to be dealing with that.
No.
I'm sorry to say, but they not going to want to deal with that.
All right, let's take another call here real quick.
Part of what happened was basically there was a time that men ran the schools. And so all that was replaced by women who had a different view. You know, men, we're on the discipline side. Women are on the more so nurturing side. And, of course, that brings an imbalance. Now they want men to come back and try to straighten the mess up, but it's like when the jack is out the box.
They ain't gonna do that. Black male professors,
right?
Just like black male professors who's carrying research dollars, they will not go to a historical black college. And then you may mention about the trauma. I hear people say black kids go through so much trauma, stepping over. Well, that kid wake up in the morning, you got to string him in going in and out of the mother's bedroom. Is that not trauma, too?
Yeah, very traumatic. You know, so you go to, man, that's a whole other thing.
People ridicule. Go ahead.
410 area code, your mic is open.
I'm not going to say anything until that caller on the number 314 is muted. You got to mute his microphone.
All right. So we won't have no fights. Go ahead.
Look, every black person in America is crazy. We're dumb. And the thing is, we've been dumb since the 50s. And all you got to do is look at the casualties. Yummy is a casualty. Now, you ask the important question, could artisans back in the day have saved Yummy?
Yes, sir.
Well, the answer to your question has already been proven. They didn't have any Yummies back in that day. And the reason why is because they controlled the environment that they lived in. And the trick is they built institutions to make sure that their children was in an environment where they could succeed. Now, you can have a debate. But the thing is, if you look back at all of those people that you have highlighted and some that you haven't. Now, the thing is, we know that black kids can be saved. All you got to do is look at the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
He raised a whole lot of men.
And women, too. And the thing is, they were drugs, pimps, robbers, killers, and everything else. So now, we don't have to invent the wheel. We see all of this out here now, but we have a bunch of intellectualized bourgeoisie, House of Diddy, black folk that don't want to get their hands dirty and go in and take control of their neighborhoods. That's what that is. You know, we have people that sit back, well, you know, them people in Chicago, they're shooting and killing and everything else. Well, those people in Chicago, you name out a lot of famous people with a lot of money. And some you didn't name out because there's so many of them. And I told you yesterday, and look, during that same time that Yummy was out there struggling, Ronald Reagan gave Marva Collins an honorary award, didn't she? And
she was even asked if she would be Secretary of Education somehow, some position way up high in the federal government.
Well,
she turned it down.
Some House of Diddy black folks would have took that position and left the school there, but she was dedicated to educating those kids. See, she couldn't be bought out.
She educated, her school was focused in on basically elementary students.
That's where it starts.
And that's
where it starts. And once you get that, lay that basic foundation, see, the rest is history. And the key thing is they went back and looked at all of those students that she graduated, and all of them were successful, productive people. So
right.
Now, here's the deal. It's on the people of Chicago and the people at large. You know, you got all of us people, and I say us, including the ones on the panel that's doing the talking. See, everything is individualized now. We aren't building communities. We don't structure communities. We don't pay people that can go in and manage communities and build institutions. Somebody say, well, the school system is screwed up. Well, Bill Bennett said, look, if the school system, he was talking about the parochial schools. I know you know who William Bennett is. He was a Republican Secretary of Education or some shit. He said, if it ain't working for you, damn it, build one that does work for you. You know what? We spend a whole lot of money on Caribbean cruises and BMWs and everything else. And the thing is, you can't get us to build a community school to train Yummy type people. We spend money just going to Las Vegas and taking trips. You say field trips. You know, when I was in Maryland, the first thing
We take field trips to Vegas, Bahamas, Atlantic City.
And thousands of dollars, and you can't get one color person to say, you know what, let's go ahead on this summer after income tax time, and let's go ahead on. And look, you don't have to like the person. You got Omar Johnson. You got Marcus Garvey Academy. You got a whole bunch of examples where Marva Collins' son is there. You got a whole bunch of people that have the expertise to go in and properly train our kids. Because now look, I survived learning about George Washington never told a lie, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves and everything. It's when you tell these modern kids that bullshit and they don't see the stuff that you've been highlighting this past month. First thing they say is, why should I learn this shit? In fact, that was said in my class. A girl asked the teacher, say, look, Negroes ain't never done that. Why should we study world history? And my teacher had to go in and change the curriculum to where we found out that black folks actually did a lot. Now, you got some idiots out here saying, well, black folks never built this country. That's a damn lie. All you got to do is just look at the colonies that came over here before slaves got here. All of them failed. But after slaves got here, that's when this country got to rolling. So now the thing is, you don't have to go back in time. The time is now. Who are the artisans now that's willing to put their money up? And I'm talking about poor folk, rich folk, and educated, and everybody else in the black neighborhood that's willing to go in now and use their skills. Now, they got to be paid. But pay them to use their skills to go ahead on and bring our community up to code. And here's the other thing. You got to have a code. See, when a person say, well, who's black? That's the problem. Because if nobody knows who the hell is black in this day and time, you know what? Evidently, they must have been born out of the mother's womb last night. Because everybody tells you who's black. All you got to do is look at the George Floyd case. All you got to do is look at the laws and the voter suppression laws. All you got to do is look at the Supreme Court laws. All you got to look at the bills that passed. If you don't know who the hell is black now, I'm sorry for you. But the thing is, you don't have to go back to what those people did back then because they did what they were supposed to do. Now, the question is, do we do what we're supposed to do? And if we're unwilling to do it and we're sitting on our ass, wringing our hands, then you know what? Genocide is coming. Planned Parenthood is doing its work. And by the year 2050, when they get all of these Hispanics in here and all of these foreigners in here, watch out, the truck's coming. Putting us in the
oven. Let me ask you this. Now, Yami was 11 years old. The two guys who killed him in the same gang were, well, the brothers was 14, one was 16. The name of the group was Black Disciples. Your take on, because the, well, all, well, these three young men, well, the two, or the four, the teenagers, we'll say they're young men. But Jummy was—he was a child. All three looking for some type of identity, and therefore
the only
they joined the Black Disciples.
The only identity they had was a group of thugs that took up time with them and gave and say, "Look, you're part of this organization, the Gangster Disciples." Same thing all
right.
over the country. You got the Crips and the Bloods and all of that garbage. Well, the thing is this. See, we grown men haven't established an identity out here. We haven't built institutions to establish an identity out here. In our schools, in our churches, and look, the thing is this. You don't have to ask Michael Jordan to contribute a whole bunch of money. In Chicago, I bet you right now you got about, what, 200 or 300 damn churches out there collecting money every day, every Sunday. And putting it in white banks when they could take that money and do what I just said. Create a school like the Catholics did with these parochial schools. Build hospitals. Go ahead on and have these afternoon programs like you talked about, recreation programs. Go in and have these little competitions, debating clubs, and going in and having poetry competitions. Writing competitions and everything else. But see, we have become artificial white folk, and we're out here trying to do the white folks' bidding by destroying ourselves. See, we need to get rid of these damn black conservatives and these black liberals. If you're black conservatives, then you'd be doing what Farrakhan's doing, trying to conserve black life. But all black conservatives, Republicans, and liberal Democrats is doing is trying to go in and conserve white power. Instead of us using our money and donating to a cause in our neighborhoods, see, we're donating to the causes of white folk. And until we realize that, Brother L.A., you're going to have a whole lot of yummies out here. Now, you know, you can bring the other people in here and you can have them go ahead on and slash me if you want to, but hey, what I'm saying is true. And it can't be debated. So let them come in here.
Well, we're going to, this 1254 where I'm at. And I get up like 3:30 in the morning. So we're going to cut it here today. I'm going to call Patrick Collins and see if I can get him in this week some kind of way. Because he's relaunching his mother's school, but it's going to be – they're doing a charter school out in Vegas. But since he's in the startup mode, because, like I said, there's a bunch of yummies out here being born every day. So, well, no, not being born. Created everything.
Brother L.A., can I say this?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You look, I don't mean no harm. And look, you can kick me in the ass when you see me. That brother had a head start, didn't he?
Which one? Oh, you talking about Patrick Collins?
Yeah, he had a head start. His mother had already established.
True. Both of his parents had him and all their children in private schools, which happened to be parochial schools, before she started her own school.
I got that. But you know what? I know it's hard to try and get black folks to finance a future. But my thing is, why would he close down her school and go to a private company and then come back and a Chinese woman have to go ahead on and carry on his mother's work?
Let's do a little fact checking on here. She had asked him to come on, I think, years ago, and he was a headmaster. They had a Marvin Collins branch of Westside Prep in Wisconsin. Later on, his sister took over the whole shebang. Okay, and then I don't know what happened. It was his sister who closed it down.
Regardless, he had the method. He knew how the thing was structured. And the thing is, he couldn't carry it on. But that's another discussion for another
right.
day. I'm
yeah,
not criticizing.
Yeah, yeah, we'd have to ask him that personally. But
that shows the failure of black people, and especially black men. See, none of this shit with Yummy could exist if black males were black men. So I just brought that up as a thought. But anyway, I'll see you later.
All right, well, we'll continue this tomorrow, everybody. Thanks for coming, talking. We'll see. Have a good rest of the day.